You're listening to PorchDrinking.com's The Porchcast, brought to you by Molly's Spirits. And now, The Porchcast.
I want to welcome all of our hosts today. We've got Corey David, our co-host, and Sammy Hartman, co-host. I'm Tristan Chan. This is episode 72 of The Porchcast, and we are very excited to be joined by Jonathan Shikes, writer for The Westward, beer writer for The Westward, and also a published author. We're talking about his book.
Hold it up, Shikes. Hold it up.
Denver Beer, A History of Mile High Beer.
Plug it, baby.
Before we go any further, I do want to quickly plug our sponsor for all of our Denver listeners or anyone visiting Denver. Explore a land of adult beverage discovery at Molly Spirits, offering a curated selection of beers, wines, and spirits in Lakeside, Greenwood Village, Colorado. Shop over 14,000 products, including exclusive collabs and extensive craft beer selection, in-store or online for curbside pickup or delivery. Learn more at mollyspirits.com. Molly's is actually doing some pretty cool whiskey drops right now, and all of the proceeds go to local nonprofits, so that's another reason to support Molly's. Shikes, thanks again for joining us. We were talking a little bit about the kind of beginning stages of the Colorado craft beer scene, talking about Coors, Zangs, Tivoli, and all that, and also Charlie Papazian really helping to create the bedwork for Colorado's craft beer scene. One of the things that really has surprised me has been kind of the different kind of evolutionary phases of Colorado's craft beer scene. You know, we talked about the very beginning stages, but in terms of modern craft beer scene, you know, it really wasn't until, you know, you had New Belgium, Odell, Great Divide, Ska, Left Hand Windcoop. Those were kind of the forefathers of modern craft beer. And then you saw that kind of resurgent wave really starting with like the Dry Docks and the Funkworks. And you talk about it a lot in your book, but Strange and also in terms of the tasting room concept getting started by Dry Dock. Tell us a little bit about these different kind of phases in craft beer here in Colorado and whether you saw any really distinct correlations in your research.
The late 80s and the early 90s were a free for all. People realized that they could brew and sell their own beer. And I think the hardest thing that they had to do then was convince the public that it was legitimate and they weren't going to die from drinking it. And that this was a real business. You know, you could actually drink. There were actually small breweries that were making their own beer. I think it was sort of a novel and difficult to understand concept, especially for the packaging breweries that didn't have a food or restaurant attached to them. For the ones that had a restaurant attached, Windcoop and Rock Bottom and Cooper Smith's up in Fort Collins, you could actually see the brewing going on when you came in to have dinner or lunch or whatever it was. And I think that was, that was a big part of what people really liked about it. But these, you know, the people who started these breweries, they came from other industries. A lot of them were teachers and engineers or scientists of some sort. And they were home brewers and they went into this professionally. And the brewers who came along, you know, much later in 2005, 2010, 15, those guys are scientists and teachers and educators. You know, a lot of they are too, and most of those were home brewers also. They made a lot of the same mistakes that the early guys made. They had a lot of fun. They had a lot of, you know, they built a lot of relationships with one another. So there was definitely some correlations between the two, but back then it was a lot different because you had to either package or sell food. And these days you can just sell beer.
Well, it's funny that you bring that up because, you know, we recently saw Denver kind of put down some regulations on breweries that kind of reverted back to this, you know, kind of more historic kind of approach towards operating a brewery where you actually had to serve food. Luckily, the city of Denver kind of rescinded some of those and those restrictions and are allowing breweries to partner here locally with food vendor providers within a 10-minute delivery zone. But, you know, it's funny how kind of by chance history kind of circles back a little bit. Yeah, Corey, I know you wanted to ask some questions about kind of how John got into writing about beer. You want to touch on that?
Yeah, John, I mean, I know you've probably talked ad nauseum about the history of Colorado beer. I mean, you wrote a book about it. At least that's what I've heard. So where does your passion for writing really start? Good man. Where did your passion for writing really start? Because you went to Northwestern, correct?
Yeah, I went to grad school at Northwestern. Yep.
Okay, and then when did you realize you could go beer full time? So where did you kind of get started with writing? How'd that start? And then how did you wind up realizing you're like, yeah, I could just write about beer all the time?
When I was in college, even in high school, I was on those student newspapers. It was just something I liked to do. I enjoyed writing early on. And
you still have any of those?
What's
you still
that?
Have any of those?
The old story?
Yeah, your original high school works.
I do somewhere. Yeah.
Wait. Remind the crowd where you went to high school.
I went to East. Woo! Yeah. Here in town.
You sure did. So did I.
Yep.
Well, we'll have to have you read one of those for the next episode of the podcast, if you could.
Okay,
please.
All right.
That'd be great.
I went to UC Santa Cruz in California and took some journalism classes there, and then went to grad school at Northwestern for journalism later. I've been in journalism since the mid-90s, and a lot of what I did was a lot of business writing. I covered all the different beats, you know, crime and cops and county government and education and environment, but I also did a lot of business stuff. And in doing that, when at one of the jobs I had, I worked for the Longmont Daily Times Call, and I got to know the guys at Left Hand a little bit. I wrote a little bit about the brewery there, and I had always been interested in beer as well. I started home brewing when I was a teenager. So when I got my most recent job at Westward in 2007, and we were looking to increase our web presence by writing about whatever we could on a daily basis rather than just being a weekly paper, I started writing about the craft beer scene because it was something I was aware of and enjoyed and paid a lot of attention to. And the more it happened to be at a really good time, 2007, 2008, because you know, within a couple of years, the tap room culture just absolutely blew up. So I started writing about every brewery that opened and about all the different trends. In terms of doing it full time, yeah, it's not a thing that I do full time.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Which it was. But it does not pay a full time salary. So I have other things that I do, but I do get to I try to write anywhere from 3 to 5 stories a week for Westward. I've written other, magazine stories and then of course the book. So it's been terrific, but it doesn't pay the bills necessarily.
Do you work, do you do any fiction at all? Any other just like personal writing that you really enjoy outside of what you do for Westward?
I spent so long as a reporter and an editor that I didn't, when you come home, you don't necessarily want to, crank on the computer again and
keep writing.
Yeah. I've written things. I haven't gotten very far in other things that I've worked on, but I've worked on other kinds of writing.
Yeah, sure. Got the first page to 50 different novels done. I understand. Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you. I don't even have 2 pages. Yeah.
Now, John, then you grew up here in Denver and you grew up reading the Westward. What was it like to become a managing editor and, write for the paper that you, for a publication that you really kind of revered as a, in early on in your career?
It was amazing. At East, when I was there, I would, with a friend of mine, we'd go across the street because we could, at lunchtime, it was an open campus. So I'd go over to Arby's and
I would. My life.
Arby's not anymore.
R.I.P.
Yep, R.I.P. Arby's. We would grab the Westward and we would read the back page because that was funny, and we would read the comics at the time because they were funny. Kenny B., who was the cartoonist, Patty Calhoun, who was the editor, a columnist. Many years later, I was working at the Longmont Times Call, and I quit and I applied at Westward. So I worked there for the last for 10 years, but before that I had worked there for 3 years in 1999 and through 2002. And all these people who I had been reading, you know, seeing their faces and walking into the newsroom was really amazing. It was one of the best. I had caller ID, and when Patty called me to tell me that she was going to give me the job, you know, it showed up on caller ID, and I saved that little caller ID and I took a picture of it, you know.
No way. That's awesome. Do you think, yeah, I mean, I know that Patty has had kind of a close relationship with beer, through, you know, the Wincoop days when Westward was located across the street, and John Hickenlooper would send the Westward beers. Do you think that was kind of integral in, you know, the Westward's focus in covering the craft beer scene so early on?
Yeah, you know, Westward was really into breweries and restaurants and drinking culture for a long time. Being across the street from the Wincoop did help quite a bit. That's where Westward was located until about 2000. And Patty was friends with John Hickenlooper, and we would go over there and have our staff meetings there, and he was always around. So that, I think that drinking culture and just the culture of going out and having fun was always important to, was always important to Westward.
Absolutely.
Well, as somebody that grew up in Colorado and you've loved here and you live here now, and you're one of the more prominent writers in the scene in regards to beer news and kind of what's happening, what was your favorite period of time in the Colorado beer scene? Even if it was just like a year or a couple of years, like, can you remember a period of time that just like is near and dear to your heart?
Yeah. I mean, I think if I had to narrow it down, I would pick there were probably two eras. One was that mid 90s where there was no internet. So, there was an internet, but
the land before time. Yeah.
You didn't, it's not really where you found out about stuff like that. So you would just go out to bars and there'd be a beer and from a brewery you'd never heard of, and it would be a brown, or it would be a raspberry beer, or an apricot beer. And it was just like every new one that you tried was just amazing. And I really loved, finding out about breweries like Tommyknocker and Oasis and Left Hand and you just didn't know what they were until you went out to a bar and found their beers, and then because mostly you didn't go to some of those packaging breweries. So I really enjoyed that era. And then more recently I loved the couple years there between about 2012 and 2015 or 16 when tap rooms were opening with just an immense amount of passion and creativity, and they were opening left and right and just blowing people away with different ideas and scrapping, to do whatever they could. And it was just a lot of fun. The festivals were starting up. The scene here was starting to really take off. And I really enjoyed that, those few years there, not so long ago.
Yeah. Well, during COVID, I mean, we've clearly had to shift the way that we consume beer and the beer industry as a whole. One of the big aspects that you kind of touched on just now was, events and beer releases and whatnot. What are you looking forward to most after things kind of get back to normal and we, maybe a vaccine's developed that we can get out and enjoy life like it used to be? Was there a particular beer festival that was always a favorite of yours, or was there a particular beer event that you really missed?
I really miss Collaboration Fest, which was one of the very first ones, probably the first one to go down to COVID. To me, that I love the idea of collaboration. Mm-hmm. I love seeing all the Colorado brewers who are there. I love seeing what happens, the beers that come out of there. The brewers, they'll either go crazy, they'll have fun, they'll really work on something. You never know what you're going to get with the different kinds of things that they make. And some of them, some of those beers blow up, or set style trends. And it was a really fun fest. So I missed that one. Of course, Big Beers, is an amazing festival. And, some of the smaller kind of the ones that would be coming up right now, everything from Festivus to to Ratio's Genius Wizard party. Those are the holiday ones are a lot of fun too, and I'm gonna miss those. I don't know if we're gonna be going back to how soon we're gonna be getting back to those. I hope we are.
Man, think about it. Like even Salida, like
yeah,
I would have killed to go to Salida this year.
Yeah.
Ugh.
Absolutely.
Yeah, maybe next year.
Have any of you guys actually tried the virtual festival thing? I haven't had any experience with it. But like, have you participated in any of those or know how they've been going down?
Nope.
Nah.
You just drink on the computer?
And sometimes they'll mail you like a mix pack of something that it's the same for everybody. Tristan, you probably know a little bit more about.
Yeah, I think it depends per state, but because depending on what's legal in terms of shipping alcohol and whatnot. But yeah, there have been a number of festivals we've covered on Porch Drinking that have been virtual festivals. GABF, of course, was also one of those, which was a little bit more unique. But our friends over at Hop Culture put together Beers Without Beards. A festival focused on women breweries, women-owned breweries, and women brewers, and so that was pretty cool to be able to see some of the panel discussions that came from those. But man, I don't know about you, Shikes, but I'm kind of wary of you know sitting in front of a computer and drinking beer for like 3 hours straight. I've kind of gotten bored of that. But I'd much rather have these kind of conversations where we can actually interact with each other. Versus, just sitting and watching like a live stream of like, you know, a panel discussion.
Yeah, they're hard to do, and they also make you remember, you know, what's actually fun, which is being out and about.
You're right, and social.
It's a painful reminder.
The whole time. Kind of
let's get a little nostalgic, and also I want some information out of you too. So. Now that we can't go to bars as much as we used to, everybody's situation's a little different. What are your like three or four quintessential, you have to have these in a good beer bar in order for it to be a good beer bar? And then what's a place that you just love? Like maybe that's off the grid and you don't have to spill any secrets if it's your secret spot, but some place you really love to go that has all those things.
Boy, I mean.
This wasn't in the pre-notes, I'm sorry.
if you take beer seriously, which you don't have to do, but if you do and you take the craft part of it seriously as a beer bar, well, first of all, you're going to want to have like some decent glassware.
Mm-hmm. Good start.
Not serve everything in pint glasses. Although I've also been getting nostalgic for pint glasses because it makes me just think about sitting down and. Well, even though I couldn't stand pint glasses before, it just reminds me of being at a bar, you know, and like filling it up and then setting it down and spilling it in your lap or whatever. And I think you've got to have a craft lager. You've got to have something local. You've got to have an IPA. You probably should have a double IPA. You should probably have somebody's stout. These days, obviously, hazies are what is in and big, big adjunct stouts are what is in. But having a decent sour of some sort or tart beer, doesn't have to be a hardcore sour, but something tart. Mm-hmm. I think if you have that's probably the good mix that shows that you're paying attention.
Are you a music or no music guy? I know some people like don't like the music at a bar.
I do not. I am not a big music guy.
Big stance.
Yeah, I'm the opposite of like, you know, so I don't have a dog. I barely see anymore. I don't like music. So I'm like, what are you doing in Colorado, man? But
wait, so does that mean that then you're also anti-TV? How do you feel about the television?
Oh, you know, I don't mind televisions in breweries. I get it. I get the breweries that don't have them, because they, you know, they don't want people staring up at the TV. But I don't think I'd put on a soap opera or a talk show. But having
sports or animals or something.
I don't know. If you put the Big Lebowski on at basically any bar, I'm down for it. I think I'm ready to watch it.
Yeah.
So with all those things in mind, do you have like your favorite watering hole for craft, like in town, that's not a brewery, or maybe a place that you still love to go to that might not be around anymore?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Walter's 303 isn't really on the, you know, they haven't quite gotten on the must stop map yet, I don't think. Maybe they have. I don't know, but
no, I think that's a great under the radar.
Yeah,
choice.
I was there yesterday.
Sorry.
Yeah, wings, yeah. Man, they're so good. Yeah,
they're awesome, and plus you can see they have their menus online, or you can see how much is left of every keg that they have with that. What is that app that they have?
Digital Pour.
Yeah.
So whatever it is.
Yeah. I don't know what is have that one, but
yeah. What else is it about the joint that you really like? Is it kind of, I haven't been, is it kind of a divey joint? Is it more modern? Like, what's the deal?
So there's two that I've been to. One is in Uptown on, I think, 19th and Pennsylvania or Pearl. And it's not divey. It's like a neighborhood, maybe. It's not fancy, but it's like a neighborhood spot.
Just right.
Yeah, yeah. It really is. They've got great pizza there, and they just have an amazing tap list. And I think, I mean, it's because of it's partially owned by John and Stacy Turk, and John worked in beer for so long. I think he's got some good connections. The one in Lowry is pretty fancy, and not fancy, but it's, you know, it's definitely more kind of a suburban spot.
Yeah, cleaner.
It's cleaner.
It's shinier. Is what
out of that Uptown kind of craziness.
But I like the Uptown. I like the Uptown one. That's a spot that I stop into whenever I can.
Cool. Yeah, I went to, so it's just based on the list. I don't know the history of the joint as well as you guys do, but like I went to the original Cherry Cricket for the first time last week.
Oh yeah, dude.
I was pleasantly surprised with how great the beer menu was. I just didn't think of it. Shikes, I mean, so I'm assuming you've been there, but like, who were some of the other places when craft really started getting rolling around here, like bars and restaurants that really helped kind of get the scene off the ground?
So there was almost nothing until Euclid Hall opened in 2010 or 11, maybe. Well, there really wasn't a whole lot.
You touched on it in the book, but I really love kind of the section where you talked about Falling Rock and how Chris Black kind of got that started. That was really interesting to me.
Yeah, I mean, he had come here for the Great American Beer Festival, and you couldn't find a craft beer in town. And that he was from Texas, and he kept it on his radar, which is why he came back here years later to open Falling Rock. But I mean, there was the Cherry Cricket, there were a couple of breweries, there was my brother's bar, you know, we've had some fun stuff, and there was Old Chicago, which was, you know, that was the place if you wanted craft beer. Governor's Park had some stuff.
R.I.P.
Yeah, R.I.P. Governor's Park. But there really wasn't anything. And then there was Falling Rock, and they and, you know, Old Chicago, kind of carried things for a long, long time. Denver was a pretty terrible beer town for a lot of years.
Do you think that's partially why so many breweries actually popped up and started serving like on their own premise? Because there was clearly a desire for beer, but a lot of establishments just weren't picking it up.
That's actually a really good point. I hadn't thought about that before, but that, you know, that's a great way of saying it. When some of those early breweries were opening up, there wasn't a lot of places to go still for craft beer. You know, I forget who. Let's see, Ops and Pie opened, Euclid Hall opened, Stoney's,
Star Bar.
What's that?
Star Bar.
Yep, Star Bar. Some of those places at the beginning. You know, really kind of got things going to the point where I think I wrote a story in 2010 or 11 where I could actually count the craft beer taps that were added in the city, because you just knew.
But isn't that wild that it was only a decade ago, considering how long the history's been? Yeah. I mean, that these guys have just been flying just on a hope and a dream that they were going to continue to stay open. And just pray that package that people were going to keep buying bottles, and that even it's been 10 years, and we've all been in the industry for almost as long, Shakes, you've been in it for a gajillion years.
Well, also, you know, we talk about this, you know, when I was working at Ratio, Jason and I used to talk about this all the time about how even when Ratio first opened, you know, I think there were only probably about, you know, 10 to 15 breweries within, you know, Denver proper at the time. And mm-hmm. I think you do a really great job, Jonathan, in the book of talking about this, you know, the different waves of breweries that kind of have come and gone, and but also these new waves that have really ushered in a new era of craft beer for the city of Denver. One of the things that I found really interesting, because, you know, whenever you read something like this, you get very nostalgic. You look back on, you know, the wide breadth of the scene. One of the things that I found that got me thinking about was just how diverse Denver's craft beer scene is in terms of style. You know, the Pacific Northwest has become known for, you know, and California as well, has been known for kind of really developing and popularizing West Coast style IPAs. We mm-hmm. all know about New England style IPAs. You know, in Texas, you've got craft lagers, which have really, you know, they've created such a wealth of producers of craft lagers. But I feel like here in Denver in particular, and also throughout the entire state of Colorado, we've got really prolific, you know, sour and wild producers. We've got some of the best lager producers in the country in our backyard in Bierstadt. You know, we've got breweries like Weldworks and Cerebral who have produced, you know, world-class, you know, adjunct stouts and barrel-aged stouts. Is that something that you have seen in your coverage, that, you know, Colorado really doesn't have much of a distinct identity in terms of stylistically, but more so just overall a wealth of talent across the board?
It's funny, because your people would ask what is Colorado's beer, and I was talking with Steve Karowski, you know, formerly of the Guild, of the Brewers Guild, and now with Laws Whiskey, and you know, he said Colorado's beer was just the red, you know, was the amber, was the, you know, fat tire. Mm. That's yeah. what Colorado, you know, that was Colorado's beer. And today, I don't know that if people would associate any kind of a style, you know, with Colorado. And I think rather than being a negative, I think, like you said, it's, you know, it's a positive. You can come here and try beers, you know, try wild fermentation beers and try lagers that have been aged in oak. And, you know, there's a brewery that does Czech styles. There's about to be a second brewery that does Czech styles.
Yep.
There's, you know, they really are, you really can find anything here. Even the breweries that make an IPA and a brown, some of them are messing around with dunkels and alts and kind of going back to old school, styles to make people happy. But there really is a ton of just about everything here.
And I mean, I think it's because even just the Denver landscape is full of people that, you know, have moved here. And so you've got just a whole swath of drinkers. And so then you've got the ability to open up a brewery that you can make really whatever you want, because you're going to find somebody that's going to want to drink it.
That's a great point, Sammy. You know, one of the things that I tell people, that I used to tell people when I first moved here, that I was, you know, most surprised about, was just how, you know, transient this city was. And, okay. and I think with it, you bring people with different tastes and different backgrounds all across the country. And so, yeah, I never thought about it that way. But yeah, I do think that our kind of like wide diversity of styles and in terms of beer could maybe be attributed to that as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Shikes, what region or state do you think is the most overrated?
Well, just in general?
Yeah, no, just for beer. I mean, you could. Yeah, it's twofold. Yeah, just in general and then beer related, because I think Colorado has one of the best beer scenes in the country, but then you've got places like Vermont, Maine, upstate New York has a lot of street cred, and even in the city, Pacific Northwest, like Oregon, you've got all of California, NorCal, SoCal. Like, is there some place that you just like, Colorado definitely does it better than these guys?
The Pacific Northwest does a couple things really, really well.
And? So what are those? What do you say they do really well?
They do lovely pale ales. They do fresh hop beers. There's a couple of unusual barrel-aged products coming out of Pacific Northwest. Yeah. They do lovely, balanced, hoppy beers. But the first time I went to Portland, all there was pale ales. Everywhere you went, it was just, there weren't even that many IPAs. It was just pale ale. Every place had like six pale ales. And maybe that's what people complain about today. Every place has, you know, eight IPAs and that sucks. But, you know, I don't know that that's necessarily true. But, you know, I love Pacific Northwest. I love visiting breweries when I go there. And I know things are not like that, you know, necessarily anymore.
You just got to be in the mood for pale ales. That's really it. That's all it comes down to.
Yeah.
I'm with you, man. I think Oregon and Washington get a little overblown, especially with a place like Oregon. I think that they've been so established for so long. They've had a craft beer scene. And then I just never hear about like a lot of major, I don't know, milestones or peaks that they've like hit in the past like few years, I suppose. I feel like the scene kind of plateaued for a certain degree.
Shikes, what are you jonesing on right now? Like, what are you drinking a lot of?
Well, I finally finished the last Marzen in my fridge. I was just going nuts for the Oktoberfest beer.
Yeah, so, you did that blind taste test, I saw.
Yeah, we tried a whole bunch of them, like 20 of them.
By the way, Shikes, I do want to bring this up before you finish that question, and I do want you to finish it, but we're working on hopefully doing a couple larger blind tastings that we want then like a couple people from the industry to join in, and we'd love to have you part of that for Porch Drinking in 2021. But sure. I definitely saw you doing some of those Martin blind tastings, and I was like, yes, this is exactly what we need. So
100%.
Yeah, no, that'd be awesome. I'd love to join you in some of that. I've been looking for 10-50 everywhere because all of a sudden the roasty stouts are on my mind and I can't find it, but I found Narwhal from Sierra Nevada.
Great.
It's a terrific beer. About 85% of what I drink is Colorado just because that's what I write about. That's what I want to drink. But, you know, when you see the Narwhal from their Russian Imperial Stout sitting there.
Yeah, you got to get on it. I found a six-pack of Celebration. I was like, thank you. Yep.
I was going to say, Sammy, that Celebration, I feel like, was probably the beer of the weekend in terms of social media. Obviously, for political reasons, I think
obviously. A lot of
people got out there. But no, I've been seeing Celebration, and what a great timing in terms of a fresh hop to drop with such a timely name. Saw Celebration totally. On all of my feeds. Now, John, I wanted to get nostalgic, but also a little sentimental for a second, because I do want to say a huge thank you to you. And you know, you and Eric Gorski and Ed Sealover, you know, you guys have all been a huge part of making Porch Drinking even possible, because, you know, when I started this thing in 2012, you know, I wasn't sure what it was going to be like entering the beer scene and covering the beer scene in terms of, you know, you guys had been around for such a long time. And I had been a fan of your all's writing, but to have you guys be so welcoming and, you know, embrace us and what we do, you know, even when we were just getting started, it meant the world to me. So I've always been super grateful of that. And I've definitely been looking forward to having you on the show because of that. I know that we get to get together for beers every now and then, not as much this year as I would like, but definitely I just wanted to say a big thank you to you for really making this such a welcoming community, which is very also indicative of the Colorado craft beer scene as a whole.
Yeah, well, thanks, Tristan. I appreciate that. I mean, that means a lot to me, and it, you know, it's not my... Being a journalist, your instinct is always to do battle with other, you know, other publications, other writers, other people. That's what the mentality is in journalism, and that's fine. But I kind of took a lesson from the brewers themselves, who were always, you know, teaming up and you know, try to bring myself around to the idea that it's a lot more fun to, you know, either hang out with, drink beer with, share stuff with other writers, and just enjoy their company and enjoy reading their stuff. It's just a lot more fun than it is to do the opposite. So that was kind of the mentality I started trying to take on, you know, kind of early on.
We only get cutthroat when it comes to fantasy brewery drafts, right?
Oh. I can't believe I still haven't won that.
Your time will come.
Well, who's the – all right, well, just – I mean, we don't have to go through an entire draft, but who are your guys' first-round picks?
Well, we did it for GABF each year, and unfortunately we didn't get to do it this year just because of all the craziness. But, you know, in the past – Shakes, who have been some of your kind of workhorses in terms of like early round picks?
I mean, I did a lot of Sandlot, Melvin.
That's right. You always pick Sandlot, I feel like.
Yeah.
And they always got you so many medals.
They always deliver.
Yeah. I mean, they always deliver. Dry Dock.
Obviously.
Dry Dock always was delivering. I think Left Hand had a pretty solid streak for a little while in there. You know, and there's other breweries like Oscar Blues, which, I mean, they make some of the most, you know, well-known beers, incredible beers, and they just don't win GABF medals. You know, it just doesn't work for them for some reason. But
I feel like you always come in like second place.
I got close. You have to win, you know, you have to win the brewery of the year. You know, you got to luck out.
Yeah. That's true.
Well, one question I guess I'll pose for Jonathan and Tristan, since you're both, you know, I guess some of the more prominent beer writers in the Denver, Colorado area. Why do you guys think it's important to write about the beer scene? Like, why should people care? I mean, I like hanging out with these people and I like drinking beer, but why do you guys think it's important to write about?
Do you want to take that one first, Jonathan?
Sure. I mean, you know, I always tell people, you know, people ask, you know, I get kind of mad when a big brewery buys a small brewery, because I really enjoy supporting small businesses the people who I know and who I see. And people say, well, that's, you know, a software company gets bought out, you know, you don't buy Kraft toothpaste, you buy Crest. And I'm like, yep, that is true. I buy Crest. Shop at Safeway. I have T-Mobile, you know, and I use a lot of big brands, but I picked this one area to really fall in love with. And I want other people to understand why Colorado is so special for beer, and why these small businesses and the people who are in this industry are so special. Not everyone, but a lot of people, you know, why it's so cool, why it adds so much to Colorado culture. And how different it is really as an industry than the majority of the other industries that are out there.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, much like, you know, there's a lot of businesses out there, a lot of other industries out there who do a lot to support their local communities. You know, you've got restaurants and, you know, local boutiques and whatnot, but really I haven't seen any other industry give back as much as I've seen from from the craft beer industry as a whole. But also you touched on these small businesses, you touched on supporting local. And, you know, I think about in your book, you mentioned, you know, you had a spotlight on Chris and Laura Bruns from Factotum, you know, former school teachers who, you know, really started their brewery by charging their credit card, you know, and buying, you know, they didn't have investors. They didn't have financial backing. They really started it on their own. You talk about the women over at Lady Justice Brewing who, you know, came from AmeriCorps, which is, you know, a program that I came out of, and are doing so much to support women locally. Talk about Raices Brewing who are starting a trend for Latino breweries. It's not just supporting local. A lot of these breweries are creating social justice movements and really making our communities a better place to live as a whole. And so that's something that has always been an inspiration to me in terms of people taking the mantle and giving back in ways that we haven't seen in any other industry before. And so when it comes to covering these stories, you know, one of the things that I really appreciate about Jonathan that we've really, you know, tried to model after as well is, you know, we don't just copy and paste press releases. We really do focus on telling true stories, in-depth reporting, and because these people put so much of themselves into their breweries, and we want to reciprocate by telling their full stories as well. So, yeah, it's my perspective.
Yeah. With the historic achievement of John Hickenlooper becoming the first brewery elected to the U.S. Senate, Jonathan, I know you'd mentioned that you'd like to see more breweries start to get involved with politics. Like, I mean, what do you mean by that? And then, like, how do you think more people can start to get involved?
You know, politics is a tough place to be. And I think the Brewers Association is with the problems that they've had recently because of COVID and membership and the money that they've lost, they're really focusing on advocacy, politics. I think that's the direction that they're going for sure. It's always good to have someone who understands an industry in a place of power because they can help explain it to other people. It's not always easy to understand the specifics of an industry. And I think Hickenlooper probably did a good job of that when he was mayor and when he was governor. And there's a lot of, there's a lot of legislation that affects small businesses, but also liquor businesses in particular, when it comes to taxation and trade and things like that. So I think having someone there, you know, is going to be helpful for just someone who can explain it to the, you know, to his buddies in the Capitol building in DC and help get across what's going on. It kind of, you know, it's kind of like locally, Tristan, you know, you mentioned before the story you guys did and the issue that's been for the last couple of days about breweries needing to be adjacent to restaurants or to have, you know, to having food on site. And something like that happens because people don't understand a certain industry. And so when you can get someone in there to explain, you know, how it's affecting the little guys, it helps a lot.
Absolutely. Well, Jonathan, I want to close out the show real quick because, you know, it wouldn't be appropriate to have you on without actually hearing what you're most excited about currently. I know a couple years ago, you put together this incredible piece talking about kind of the most essential breweries to represent the state of Colorado. I'm curious to hear if you know, that list has evolved since that time, because I know a lot has changed in the craft beer scene, but I'd also love to hear about maybe what breweries over the past 9 months of COVID that you've maybe gotten to go or gotten to try for the first time that you've been really excited about. And if there are any breweries that you're really excited about that haven't opened yet that are on the horizon.
In terms of the list I did, it was the 30, you know, the 30 beers that I felt like were the most important to Colorado history. And it was a very subjective list, obviously. And it came, I asked other people to help me out with it. I ran it by people who had been in the scene for a while. But those beers that I had in there, I think I would probably still stick to them. You can debate some of the breweries and some of the beers a lot, but I tried to make it beers that had an effect on so many other breweries and so many people and caused a little bit of a wave, you know, that really changed things. So I would probably still stand by that list. In terms of breweries that I love right now, I constantly talk about Four Noses and New Image. I feel like the amount of creativity coming out of both of those breweries. I mean, New Image doesn't even know what to do with itself. It just every week it's exploding with, you know, some other new experiment that they're trying, you know, and before they get done with that one, they're on the next thing. But they also have a decent, distribution channel and Four Noses, similar, just enormous amount of creativity and really good beers in a variety of styles. Not just like new and crazy things, but straightforward styles as well. Those two breweries are doing an amazing job. The Czech lagers, I've been drinking a lot of hazy beers over the last, a lot of hazy IPAs over the last 3 years.
Most and, people, yeah, you're not alone.
And they're delicious. And I'm going to continue to drink a lot of hazy IPAs. But man, I've been having a good time with Czech lagers and some of the more flavorful lagers that are out there. And, you know, Four Noses has an oak-aged lager. They did an oak-aged Marzen, and now they've got another one coming out here shortly.
They have the Fooder Maybach that's coming out that I'm really excited about.
Oh, dang.
Yeah, that's the one.
Yeah.
So, you know, that kind of thing is really cool. I think True is coming out with a, like, they're gonna bottle a Bock, I think, and they've been up in their lager game a lot. So that's been kind of fun because I just hadn't focused a lot over the last few years. And so kind of opening myself up to some of that stuff has been enjoyable. Seed Stock, you know, has some really cool stuff. So yeah, I've been trying to spread out a little.
Nice. Well, thank you once again for joining us on the show. I want to plug your book once again. You can hold it up for us once again. I think this is a tremendous opportunity for people if they're thinking of gift giving for the holiday season. You've got a craft beer fan in your family, or you know, someone that you, who really loves beer and wants to get to know the craft beer scene a little bit better. I think Jonathan has done a tremendous job and kind of going from, you know, the very beginning stages of beer in Colorado all the way to the current really capturing the essence of Colorado craft beer. So be sure to look for it on, is it, you said Amazon, online, you can find it. Denver Beer, A History of Mile High Brewing.
Yeah. I mean, it's on the big websites. Hit me up on social media or on Etsy. And
he's sitting on a lot of product right now. He's got, this is taking up room at his house.
Really hope that there's just a spike in your Etsy sales. You can attribute it all to the Porchcast. Well, thanks for joining us, Jonathan. I really appreciate your time. And it's always a pleasure to kind of get your insight on the Colorado craft beer scene. You do so much for this industry, and we really appreciate having you on. Big thank you to Sammy Hartman and Corey David once again for co-hosting. And a reminder to all of our listeners out there, if you haven't already followed us on Spotify, Stitcher, iTunes, whatever listening device that you're listening to, please be sure to give us a follow and give us a little rating if you so feel appropriate. And also a big thank you to our sponsors of the show, Molly Spirits, for all of our Denver listeners or anyone visiting Denver. Explore a land of adult beverage discovery at Molly Spirits, offering a curated selection of beers, wines, and spirits in Lakeside and Greenwood Village, Colorado. Shop over 14,000 products, including exclusive collabs and an extensive craft beer selection in-store or online for curbside pickup or delivery. Learn more at mollyspirits.com. Once again, this has been episode 72 of the Porchcast. We'll check you later.